episode 29 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. And thank you for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by an all-star cast of computer lawyers, Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Our guest commentator today, we're really very pleased to have him, is computer crime law guru Oren Kerr. Oren, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes, it's a pleasure. Oren is a professor of law at George Washington University, a scholar of computer crime law and internet surveillance issues, and the go-to guy, whether you're on the bench or in the bar, for computer law developments. And I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, holding the record for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. So why don't we get started? As is traditional, we begin with This Week in NSA, a little bit slim pickings, but interesting stories nonetheless. Snowden has now gone on TV to claim that he saw NSA employees passing around pictures of naked people. I'm going to be asked that you color me skeptical about this, that he shows up with that at the last minute when his 15 minutes of fame is slowly drifting away from him. He's said a lot of stuff that, when you actually get the facts behind it, turns out to be highly misleading, if not untrue. And my guess is we're going to discover that what he's talking about is somebody brought a Playboy playmate into work one day. But we'll see. If he comes up with proof, then maybe we will find that more troubling than I do right now. Glenn Greenwald's venture reported, this is kind of the most shocking story about NSA and GCHQ yet, that GCHQ has developed the ability to send spam to people on the internet and to rig web polls so that they come out to a favored result. This has to be Snowden's Dr. Evil moment to discover that GCHQ is using techniques that will allow the agency to send spam to people all around the internet. What will they think of next? Link bait titles that are automatically generated so that you won't believe what this person has done, and your heart will break when you read this story. I'm kind of astonished that they're selling that as a scandal, but there we are. And that's all the news in NSA, except that GCHQ is pursuing legislation to ensure that data retention stays in effect. In fact, we talked about this last week and said legislation was proposed. This week, it looks like legislation is adopted. Is that right, Michael?
That's right. In the UK, they can pass legislation a heck of a lot more quickly than our government can in Washington, D.C. What they passed is now called the Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Act 2014, which primarily reinstitutes data retention requirements, which were called into serious question in April when the European Court of Justice struck down the Data Retention Directive. The UK and lots of other EU member states had instituted data retention rules pursuant to that directive. But when the court struck down the EU directive, there was a lot of question about whether the implementing legislation and regulations had any force of law. And so the UK sought to dispel any doubt and make sure that communications providers were continuing to retain non-content data by passing this new law. The most interesting part of it to me is that there's also now an amendment to the previous, Online Investigations Act called the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act 2000, which explicitly makes its warrants extraterritorial. And so the law now says that the UK government can serve warrants on companies based outside of the UK and require them to turn over communications, both content and non-content data. And that's an issue we'll be talking about with Oren later, and it's one that was has been raised now in the Microsoft search warrant case. But here, unlike the Stored Communications Act in the U.S., now you've got the so-called RIPA in the U.K., explicitly providing for extraterritoriality. So it makes for an interesting contrast.
Am I right? They did this, the government did this in part because a bunch of U.S. companies were resisting this on legal grounds, saying we don't think that you have the authority under existing law to require us to retain and then cough up this data. It suggests there might be some limits to the strategy that U.S. companies are also adopting here of fighting everything that they used to say, okay, it looks like you have at least a plausible argument on.
You know, I think that's right. I think, you know, claims were made by companies that there was no such extraterritorial power before this amendment, and the government made contrary claims. I'm not sure whether it ever came to a head in the form of an actual contested search warrant. I don't know, maybe Oren or Jason knows. But I think, you know, whatever the case was, as of now, the government clearly has the power under its own law, but let's see if they can actually enforce it with respect to data held, for example, in the United States.
Yep. Okay, well, let's move along unless somebody else wants to jump into this one. Let me talk a little bit about the right to be forgotten, because we are slowly learning more about how that's going to be administered. This is the doctrine that requires search engines to delete links that at least to people by name that people object to on the grounds that they're irrelevant or outdated. European Court of Justice made that the determination that that was required by the existing data protection directive. Google has been trying to administer that. Bing has now announced that they are going to be following suit and deleting things on request. The details of that yet to emerge. Google originally, I think Google probably thought it was going to do what they do in China, which is every time they take out a relevant search link in response to government censorship, they tell you, you know, some of the links are missing here because of government action. That was immediately shot down by data protection authorities and advocates in the EU, saying, well, that'll just tell everybody that there's something, that this person has something to hide. So Google did the second best thing, which was to tell the people who'd written the articles, by the way, your article's not going to get linked. There's been a complaint, and we have deleted the link. And that led to some unfavorable stories, which led to the data protection authorities now starting to lean on Google not to tell even the people who are the victims of censorship that they've been censored, their link is no longer, you know, it's down the memory hole. You know, we don't know the details of this because it's really something Google does with its algorithm, and it negotiates behind closed doors with the data protection authorities, at least at this stage. I am struck by the differences and the similarities to China. The Chinese censorship regime depends in part on keeping exactly the censored terms to censoring those in, as well, so that you don't even know what they're worried about. That has to be discovered by trial and error. And they rely heavily on self-censorship, which again is what Google and now Bing are going to end up having to do. So they censor themselves and apparently are not allowed to tell anyone what censorship terms they're going to be using. It's kind of remarkable and not irrelevant to Americans, because one of the hot issues is that the European data protection authorities are apparently saying, this is no good unless you censor the information that Americans get too. We want Google.com to be censored under these regimes as well. Kind of a remarkable confluence of censorship techniques, and I think probably the Chinese could learn something from the Europeans, since the Europeans have been much more effective at bending the search engines to their will. And let me turn now to a lighter note. The FBI has discovered driverless cars, and of course one of the first things they worried about was driverless getaway cars, because that means that you tell it where you're going, and then you have more people who can shoot out the window as the police are chasing you. Of course, the problem is that currently, as envisioned by Google, these are more like driverless golf carts. They go about 25 miles an hour. That's got to be the slowest getaway since O.J. Simpson got on the highway in his white Jeep. And that raised the question for me, at least, and maybe Michael or Jason or Oren, you have a view. If you hacked your Google getaway car so that it went faster than it was supposed to, and couldn't be easily stopped, have you violated any law? If you hack a car that is connected to the Internet, isn't that a CFAA violation, unless it's maybe – it depends on whose network you're really on. Is it a DMCA violation to break the protection that prevents you from going over 25 miles an hour?
Well, this is Michael. I would say it's definitely a CFAA violation if you either take information from the car or if you cause the car to crash and thereby damage the computer that controls the thing. Outside of those circumstances, I'm not sure I can see a violation.
So that means,
but at least in those cases.
This is Oren. I'd actually have the opposite reaction. If it's your car, I don't think you can exceed authorized access to it, and you control authorization as to whether you're damaging it. So you might damage somebody else's car, and then that would end up being a CFAA violation.
In the world where everything has
a computer, everything is a CFAA violation. That's maybe the easiest answer. But if you own the computer, that is, you own the car, the CFAA shouldn't apply because you're giving consent authorization to damage or authorize it.
So let me push on that.
I agree. I thought we were talking about someone else hacking your car.
Let me be a little more pointed, because I think that all makes sense to me. But doesn't that argue strongly that Google or Ford is going to say to you, by the way, you don't own the computer system that runs your car. We own it, and we're licensing it to you under certain restrictions, and one of the restrictions is you can't hack it to go more than 25 miles an hour.
Well,
and then I think it is a CFAA violation, isn't it?
Well, I guess, first of all, if we're dealing with, you know, a bank robbery and then an added CFAA violation, the CFAA violation is going to be the least of anyone's concern. but that depends on whether, you know, violating the term of service constitutes a CFAA violation, on which there's disagreement. And then also whether you can just kind of announce you don't own the that there's a separate question of how much use right to a computer makes you enables you to control authorization. So presumably, for example, the system administrator of a network controls authorization to that network, even though typically he is not the actual property owner of the network. So that would be a separate question. But I tend to think it's the bank robbery liability that's still the most important one.
Yep, go ahead.
I was going to say, sir, this is Jason. I also worry about a completely different public safety problem, which is, you know, someone else hacking into your car and causing your car to do things that you don't intend for it to do. You know, it's turning the car into a weapon.
Drive to the First American Bank and wait for 5 minutes. We'll come out and jump in.
Well, I was thinking more like drive into a crowded street with and run over a bunch of pedestrians and overcome the safety controls. So the same reason why people often worry about having their security system in their home controlled by their mobile device, you know, that they're worried about or should be worried, I think, about the chance that it could be hacked and then used for a nefarious purpose.
I think that's right, although we are going to have people who want to hack these cars, who will say, my car is, drives like a little old lady. I want a car that drives like me and drives a little faster, changes lanes more frequently, and doesn't always obey the speed limit once we get to Wyoming. Surely people will want to do that. There will be mods that are sold on the internet, and the car companies are going to hate that. So is the U.S. government going to hate it. But at the same time, as soon as people start hacking their cars, you will certainly see malware designed to do some of those things without people being willing to have it happen. All right. Well, so driverless getaway cars, probably the least of our worries as we move to a driverless car society. I couldn't let this day go by without pointing out that we have yet another candidate for a Privy Award. We've had two very recently arising from government telling us, don't worry, we are protecting privacy, and the privacy we're protecting turns out to be remarkably convenient for government officials. And the first of those was an announcement that or a story in the Washington Post showing that people who complained about the Veterans Administration's treatment of patients were threatened with prosecution under HIPAA because they had included information about the patient's treatment or mistreatment in their emails, even their emails to others in the agency. So it turns out that people protected by the health information privacy are Veterans Administration officials. And then everybody on the right has been excited about Lois Lerner's disappearing emails and the fact that she couldn't get them back. She had a computer crash. Usually people who lose stuff in a computer crash, if you care enough and you're willing to use enough forensic tools, you can get most of that stuff back. You just have to be willing to spend enormous amounts of time and money doing it. But when the House of Representatives investigators said, okay, we're willing to do that, give us the hard drive, the IRS said, oh, I'm sorry, but we completely destroyed that and utterly put anything that was on it beyond any possible recovery because taxpayer privacy. So once again, turns out that the privacy laws turn out to be remarkably effective at protecting the powerful and the privileged, maybe not so much at protecting the rest of us. At least that's my view. I have no doubt that Michael and others have slightly different views. All right. I don't know if you guys saw this. I thought it was fascinating. There's an espionage case that's going forward in the Middle District of California in L.A., and there was a FBI affidavit attached to that about what turned out to be a Chinese ring in which the middleman, there were a bunch of cyber hackers who broke into looks like Boeing's computer system, and then the guy that was actually arrested was the guy who was selling that stuff to companies in China, and it was a really, I won't say it was novelistic, but it was certainly worth reading for the insight it gives to the world of Chinese hackers, which is not quite as glamorous as one might hope, since they apparently break into these systems and then hope to find somebody who's willing to buy it. And they complain about how cheap the Chinese companies are about buying stolen plans for the for U.S. Cargo planes and fighter planes and the like. Michael, Jason, did you guys look at the at that affidavit?
You know, I did, and I, one of the things I was struck by is the fact that in the intrusion that is discussed in the complaint, that it was accomplished through phishing. It was an email that was sent to an employee that looked legitimate, and that the employee clicked on a link or opened a file, and that's what caused the malware to get on the system. And what struck me about it is, you know, Boeing's a big company. It's a clear defense contractor, as sensitive about cybersecurity as probably any company, and has probably spent tens of millions of dollars on technical measures to try to harden the network and stop an intrusion. And it highlights the fact that your employees are your last line of defense. You have one employee who opens an email that's designed to look legitimate could inadvertently put malware in your system that undermines all those millions of dollars of infrastructure investments. Google probably ought to be working on a userless email account rather than a driverless car.
Yeah, and I'm sure that the email looked like it came from somebody that this guy reported to in the company or in the government.
You know,
Go ahead.
I was going to say, to me, the most interesting part of the affidavit was the first paragraph in which the agent says that he formerly worked at a law firm, clerked for a federal judge, and was also an investment banker. That's not a profile you typically see at the FBI, and I think it explains why the affidavit is really quite lawyerly in laying all the facts out and definitions and background on the relevant statutes. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, that's Noel Neiman. Actually, I have encountered him on behalf of clients when he was doing investigations of other kinds of espionage matters. So I already knew him, and that's really why I read the whole thing. He obviously is one of the stars of the Bureau, and he's really sunk his teeth into these Chinese espionage cases.
It made me realize, too, you know, if I had stayed in the government, I'd be 4 years away from retirement. Yeah, you just need 20 years in and reach age 50. And now that I'm 50, 4 years from retirement, it looks awfully sweet.
Yeah, but that just means you have to get your second job and begin your second career. And you've already had three or four careers, so I'm not sure that it really would be that different in experience. We ought to cover very briefly, because we talked about the West Virginia case dealing with class actions involving health information compromises, and it looks as though Illinois, we were joking that people were going to start moving from the class action bar from all over the country to West Virginia. It looks as though the class action lawyers in Illinois probably should be packing their bags first. Is that right, Michael?
Yeah, that's right. We talked a few weeks ago about this West Virginia Supreme Court decision, which basically found that plaintiffs in a breach action had standing, even though there was no monetary harm or other concrete harm, because the court said that there was a recognized right under state law to medical information confidentiality and to privacy generally. And so that really blows a huge hole in the typical standing doctrine that rules, at least in federal courts. And the Illinois court, a lower-level court, basically said, yeah, we considered this rationale, and we don't buy it, and we find the more general treatment of this issue in other courts more persuasive. Not a lot of reasoning there, so I'm not sure how much persuasive effect that this ruling will have, but at least it shows that – it shows that the West Virginia decision is – very much in the heads of class action lawyers, and so we'll see it being shopped around to other judges in other states.
Yep, we're not done with that decision. It's going to pop up everywhere. And here's this other topic I want to cover just because it's so obvious to lawyers and So it seems to be so shocking to the technorati. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court said, yes, you really can be forced to cough up your password and decrypt your hard drive. There's this widespread view in the digital world that, oh no, that would be shocking to be asked to decrypt something that you encrypted. But the SJC pretty much walked through the analysis that allows the government to force you to do that, and it really just depends on whether the government already knew you owned the files. Isn't that right, Jason?
That is right, although that view that you described in the digital community is actually taking hold in some courts. There's a sort of a battle playing out between the Fourth and Fifth Amendment that's been playing out up to now mostly in federal court, but the SJC in Massachusetts is the most prominent state court to engage. But as you said, the issue for the court is whether it's a foregone conclusion that the defendant or that the subject of the warrant owned the digital media and had the ability to encrypt them. And it's a very fact-based inquiry. There are courts that have come out in different directions. Most prominently, the 11th Circuit in the federal system in 2012 ruled the other way, said that a suspect in a child porn case was not required to decrypt his hard drives because the government did not produce sufficient independent evidence to meet this foregone conclusion test. That is, the government couldn't demonstrate with any degree of particularity that the defendant knew the existence or location of the encrypted files or had the capability to decrypt them. And so I think it is, it's not a shocking legal conclusion, but it's based on a real fact-based analysis. And I think there are several courts that have really struggled with what they perceive as a compulsion order that requires the defendant to basically incriminate himself. And you know, the essence of the foregone conclusion doctrine is that whatever testimonial act is represented by your providing the decrypted media is essentially rendered non-testimonial if the existence and possession and authenticity of the evidence is a foregone conclusion. And it's really incumbent on the government to make a sufficient factual showing that it's really a no-brainer that the digital media is yours, if they want to be able to overcome that.
And can't the government, even if it's not a foregone conclusion, doesn't the government have a second arrow in its quiver? They can say, okay, fine, we will immunize you about that one fact. We will not tell anybody at trial that you decrypted these files. But we'll just tell them where we found them. And if you want to argue that somebody put them there, go right ahead. We won't contradict you by saying, how come you knew the password?
Well, up to now, the courts haven't been willing to go there. Most of the courts that have considered this and have come out in favor of the defendants have said that the very act of producing the decrypted media is itself a testimonial act. And it also creates some serious derivative use issues for the government. If you were to enter into an arrangement like that and agree not to use it, you'd have to agree not to use it derivatively too. And there'd be some, just a chain of suppression motions I would imagine that would flow from that, as the defendant would argue that every single piece of evidence the government had after that was the result of the decrypted media.
Okay, well, that's news and useful news. So we've got a critical mass here of computer crime lawyers on the show. Everybody, with the possible exception of me, knows a lot about computer crime. And so what I was hoping we could do is a kind of speed dating a review of computer crime doctrine and developments. Michael, you could get us started, and just you and Oren, and then Jason can jump in and walk us through all of the hot issues in computer crime law today.
Sure. Yeah, I'll start off talking with Oren briefly about the Microsoft search warrant case, which, as our regular listeners know, we filed a brief on behalf of Verizon, an amicus brief supporting Microsoft's position. And it was kind of funny to me in researching and then drafting the brief. There was one point in which we were responding to an argument the government had made, in which they cited no judicial authority whatsoever, but they cited one of Oren's many articles. And so in an early draft, I'd written something along the lines of, you know, the government cites no judicial authority, but just relies on an article by a former prosecutor. You know, much surprised that a prosecutor would support them. Well, we ended up taking out that line because we realized, well, we wanted to cite another article by Oren as well. And that doesn't really he's, you know, Oren is cited on both sides of pretty much all computer crime cases that come to a written decision. And I think that's an interesting place to be. I don't know how you feel about that, Oren, but it's quite remarkable.
I always enjoy it when my work is useful to the courts.
And cited.
Happy to be part of the conversation.
Well, you had a blog a couple of weeks ago that hopefully I'm going to respond to this week, but where you went through a lot of the legal issues raised by that case, and one of the things that struck me was I think to me the central point of the article was that there's a lot of confusion in this area, and that the Stored Communications Act doesn't really resolve. It doesn't even address the territoriality question of, you know, whether a warrant can apply to data stored abroad. And the upshot of that for me is, well, that just means Microsoft wins this case, because Microsoft's central argument, and I think the central argument we made in the amicus brief, is that you've got this doctrine called the presumption against extraterritoriality, which says that if Congress has not expressly addressed the question of territoriality or extraterritoriality in a statute, that the statute won't apply abroad. And so if the statute's unclear, that means it doesn't apply to data abroad. And you don't get into the presumption. It's probably because it wasn't as interesting as the deeper issues that you were more intrigued by. But I wanted to get your thoughts on the presumption and how you think it comes into play here.
Oh, I absolutely agree with the presumption. I assume the Stored Communications Act only works territorially. The Wiretap Act only works territorially, and the Stored Communications Act is such a close cousin of the Wiretap Act. I think the same principle of territoriality applies. And then the really tricky question is how does it apply? Because the text of the Stored Communications Act isn't clear if, you know, what matters. If you have the company in the U.S., the data outside the U.S., the disclosure, which you could sort of model as being either inside the U.S. or outside the U.S., if you say the statute is territorial, what counts? Is it the initial location of the data? Is it where the disclosure occurs? Is it where the company is? That, I think, is the real question in the case. And no, neither of the parties are really focused on this. But I think that's really what matters. And that's just a hard question I don't really know the answer to. So I agree with you, territoriality is the key. But I just don't know how that applies. And so, for example, Microsoft assumes that it applies to the location of the data, and that if the data is outside the U.S., then the statute doesn't apply. Maybe, but, you know, why, just looking at the text of the statute, why isn't it the location of the company? You could look at the Stored Communications Act as either modeling, sort of regulating providers, that is, regulating the companies and their disclosure, or you could model it as regulating data which happens to be held by providers. And I genuinely don't know how you resolve that tension. So I ultimately kind of conclude I just don't know which way the case should come out.
Right. But one of the ways I think it may be possible to get around that conundrum, at least in this specific case, given the ambiguity of the statute, is to think more about the seizure aspect than the search. Because if the data is currently located in Ireland, even if you buy the government's view that a search doesn't happen until the government actually looks at the data here in the United States, there is something happening in Ireland when the data is first located and then copied by Microsoft in order to provide it to the government. So it seems to me that there is an easier argument to be made on Microsoft's side that at least a search is happening outside the United States when the data is first copied. And you've written about this in one or two articles, that there is a seizure when a copy is made, even if it's a very brief, almost inconsequential impediment or burden on the provider's network. There is something that happens in that moment of copying which constitutes a seizure.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the subject of the warrant is a U.S. person, which we don't know, then there would be a Fourth Amendment seizure when Microsoft, at the government's direction, copies the file off of the server. And yet, assuming that's the case, I don't know how that helps Microsoft. So, I think if that's right, we don't know if it's a U.S. person, but if it's a U.S. person, there's a seizure. With that said, you know, okay, how does that impact whether Microsoft is required to comply with the Stored Communications Act warrant or not? I don't see how that turns into Microsoft not being sort of being free to ignore the warrant based on that Fourth Amendment conclusion.
Well, to me, it does make a huge difference because if the seizure is happening in Ireland, even if Microsoft is a U.S. company, the seizure is happening abroad. Therefore, the warrant is powerless to require that seizure because it's happening abroad. I mean, everybody, I think, really, at the end of the day, agrees that a warrant doesn't apply extraterritorially. But as you say, the question is, what does extraterritorially mean in this context? And if the seizure is happening when the data is copied, and it's copied over in Ireland, then that means the seizure is happening there, and the warrant can't require that seizure.
Right, but the warrant, the argument I think would be that the warrant is requiring it as a matter of statutory law, not constitutional law. So the Fourth Amendment does not require a warrant in this setting because it's an extraterritorial seizure, and so therefore there's no warrant requirement abroad under Second Circuit law. But the statute is requiring Microsoft to comply with this court order, which we call a warrant, assuming that we're within the territoriality of the Stored Communications Act, the statutory question. So I don't think the Fourth Amendment arguments really go either way. And I also think, you know, these would be the Fourth Amendment rights, if any, of the customer, and it's a ex ante challenge, so the warrant hasn't been executed yet, so we don't know if there are any constitutional questions. So I tend to think the real question is just, does the Stored Communications Act require compliance with this warrant, given that the data is overseas? It's just a question of the territoriality of the statute, not a Fourth Amendment question.
Yeah, no, I totally agree because, you know, we haven't really raised it as a Fourth Amendment issue, just as a statutory interpretation issue. So I fully agree with you that this is really an SCA question, not a Fourth Amendment question at this point in the litigation.
So a lot of this is going to be confused or mooted by if the Supreme Court reconsiders the Smith against Maryland third-party doctrine. And I'd sort of like your all thoughts on that one because this is the doctrine that says that if you trust your information to a third party and the government wants it, they don't need a search warrant, they can just subpoena it. You don't have an expectation of privacy in it. I wondered whether you think the court really is ready to reconsider that.
I mean, I think it's incredibly hard to know. We really don't have enough in the way of signals to have a clear sense of what the court would do with Smith versus Maryland. You know, none of the justices on the court today were around at the time of Smith versus Maryland. There are some, you know, if you look at Riley, everybody scans Riley to try to figure out what the court might do with Smith. And I think there's some clues that point one way and other clues that point the other way, a footnote that says we're not considering this one way or the other. So I think, honestly, I just have no idea. And I think the lower courts are going to divide, and then it'll be a really interesting Supreme Court case at some point. Although I suspect it won't arise in the context of the NSA Section 215 program. I think it'll probably arise in some other context, like cell site data acquisition in a criminal case, probably more likely. But I think just, you know, we're going to have to wait and see. And one of the big questions comes up, if the court does take on Smith versus Maryland is, what exactly is the alternative? You know, is it some sort of mosaic theory, you know, some aggregation and analysis, standard? And if so, what's the standard? Something more like the 11th Circuit's approach in the recent cell site case, United States versus Davis, where they just say, you know, categorically we treat this information as protected, even if the government's only collecting one piece of data, because we sort of declare it protected, even though it's something that under other cases would have been considered public and open. So I think there are just a lot of different choices that the Supreme Court could pick from, but it's really hard once you say, you know, okay, if you don't want to do Smith versus Maryland, what's the alternative? And here I think, you know, I was very interested in Justice Alito's concurring opinion in Riley, the cell phone case, which, you know, Alito's concurring opinion gets overlooked, I think, because the court was unanimous as to the result. But he had some really interesting ideas, and first of all, it suggests that he's probably not going to follow this mosaic theory idea, or say that cell site data, for example, is protected because there's statutory regulation of the issue. So he suggests in Riley that where Congress has stepped in and tried to regulate something by statute, the court should not step in the Fourth Amendment setting. And since the controversial applications of Smith versus Maryland are all areas where there's extensive statutory regulation, I suspect that means that Justice Alito would be a vote for the government in those cases. So that's interesting in part because going back to the Jones GPS case, there we have sort of the patching together of four votes from Alito's concurring opinion and Sotomayor's opinion to get to five votes in favor of this mosaic concept. And it may be that actually we walk in the door with only four votes in favor of that mosaic idea because there's statutory regulation. So I think it's a big open question. It'll be a really neat case when the Supreme Court gets there, but I don't think we really know what they might do.
You know, it's interesting. Alito said basically the same thing in his concurrence in Jones, in his opinion in Jones, that these are lines that are best drawn by Congress. And as you said, these are lines that Congress has at least tried to draw, maybe, earlier in history than so early in history they need to redraw them, but that they're first and foremost Congress's lines to draw. This is one area where I think that as much as the court in some of the recent opinions has distinguished between the privacy intrusion represented by electronic evidence and privacy intrusion represented by other non-electronic investigative techniques, this is one area in considering the future of Smith where I think you can't divorce the third-party doctrine from the physical world context, because the third-party doctrine is at the heart of how law enforcement collects all kinds of physical world evidence. You know, every time a prosecutor or an agent sends a subpoena to your bank for records of every financial transaction or credit card transaction you've engaged in, or subpoenaed to Western Union to find out about all the money that's been wired, or even to Federal Express to find out what packages you've sent. And, of course, even when they get a record of the calls you made from the landline in your house, which is your most protected space, all of that is derived from the third-party doctrine. So it would be catastrophic for law enforcement for the third-party doctrine to go away. Less catastrophic, not convenient, but less catastrophic if the court were to categorically declare cell site information, for example, to be protected, notwithstanding the fact that it arguably meets the classic definition of the third-party doctrine. But for the doctrine to go away entirely, I think would have ramifications far beyond whatever the immediate case was that was in front of the court.
Although I think everything you said, including banking records, is already the subject of legislative action, so that if you follow our presumed Alito rule, none of it would be regulated by the Fourth Amendment. Although I think an Alito rule that says we're not going to impose Fourth Amendment restrictions on data that nobody in Congress cared enough about to regulate would certainly be counterintuitive.
Yeah, I mean, it does create an interesting dynamic where if you accept Alito's, if you accept the idea that once Congress steps in, the Supreme Court stays out, then of course DOJ has an incentive to enact very weak sauce privacy protections and encourage Congress to have some very low standard, something like the Pen Register statute, you know, sort of barely any threshold, really easy for the government, and then the problem's done. I suspect that Alito's probably the only, mostly going on Riley, but also questions and argument. I suspect he's probably the one who would take that view consistently, and that it's really going to be a question of are there five votes for any specific approach? I mean, what I find really interesting about the third party doctrine issues is there's so many different standards, and for example, the mosaic approach that aggregation and analysis is the key. I have a hard time finding people who are even willing to tell me how that might apply among the proponents of the mosaic theory. So people say, oh, this is absolutely what the Constitution means. And then I'll say, okay, well, how would it apply to these facts? And invariably I get the response, well, that's why we have judges. Judges are very wise and they'll be able to figure it out. So if even the proponents of the theory decline to say how it would apply to a set of facts, that makes it a hard, you know, that's tricky for courts. And Supreme Court justices are going to be very sensitive to this idea of, you know, how do you know what the rule is? And we see this in Riley, bright line rule, clear guidance for law enforcement. And so, you know, it's one of those situations where you have to pick the least bad rule, I think. Like, there's no perfect answer from the courts. And, you know, I think the Supreme Court always, they always want there to be a nice, easy answer to problems. And the idea of picking the least bad rule never makes them very happy. So it's going to be a really interesting case once it gets there, which I suspect it will in, you know, maybe 2-3 years.
Yeah. The more this proliferates in the lower courts, I suspect the less likely the court is to want to do it, because any decision other than reaffirming Smith is not a decision that they make in one case. It's a decision to take 20 more.
Oh yeah, if they adopt the mosaic theory, then it becomes. I think of that as it's the Miranda of Fourth Amendment law. So you just like in Fifth Amendment law, you get Fifth Amendment cases, which are relatively small in number, and Miranda cases, which are, you know, like one or two a term over 40, 50 years. You would have, you know, a steady stream on the Supreme Court's docket of mosaic theory cases. Maybe they would want to do that, maybe they wouldn't, but I think it's so complicated that you'd have to have this kind of, it'd be like its own body of law, a subset of Fourth Amendment doctrine just on the mosaic theory.
I suggested in one panel that it would be the judiciary's Vietnam. So if you were going to rewrite ECPA then, I mean, there's all kinds of proposals to rewrite ECPA, and if they're ever going to have a chance of passing, it's in this, the last couple of years of the President Obama's term, because there'll be all these civil libertarian Republicans. Do you actually see ECPA getting rewritten, and what would your top priorities be for doing that?
So what seems to me odd about the current beyond the fact nothing is getting through Congress at all, right? So that's like the starting point that frames all these discussions. But you know, the big part of ECPA that everyone agrees is terrible is the part that ironically seems to matter the least, which is the lack of a clear warrant requirement for remotely stored data. So as most of the listeners who've made it this far into the podcast will know, the Stored Communications Act has a warrant requirement in some settings, but not other settings. So a lot of what's stored in the cloud should not be protected under the statute. And that part of the statute has largely been eclipsed by court rulings and, perhaps more importantly, provider practice, where the providers themselves won't disclose the information without a warrant. So it seems to me we end up with kind of a de facto warrant requirement, even though the statute says that there is no requirement. And that creates an odd environment, because the natural way you'd start to change the statute is by adding the warrant requirement, or making that a clearer warrant requirement. And yet, that actually doesn't seem to matter so much, practically speaking, because there already is this de facto warrant requirement. So we're sort of stuck in that the most outdated part of the statute has almost become obsolete in practice. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but it's sort of approximating reality. And the part that I would want to focus on the most would be these jurisdictional questions that we've been talking about. All the questions of territoriality, foreign government access to U.S. data, U.S. data to stuff that's stored overseas. That's the part of the statute that Congress just never contemplated. It was just a non-issue in 1986 or even in 1994 or 2001. And I'd love to see Congress actually try to grapple with those questions and come up with some answers, because, you know, we just debated the Microsoft case. The bottom line to that is, whatever the answer is under current law, it's not something that Congress ever thought about. So I'd love to see that be the subject of legislative attention.
Are any of the proponents of ECPA reform even talking about those issues? It seems like all you read about are, you know, the search warrant issues and whether you need a warrant for all sorts of content.
They haven't been. You're totally right, Michael. But I wonder if the courts, however the court rules in the Microsoft case and however that gets appealed up to the Second Circuit, you know, I would think there are powerful interests on both sides that could go to Congress, if it's DOJ or, you know, Microsoft and Apple and the major companies, saying, this is a huge issue. Here's the case that has resolved it under current law, and we just need a better answer. So, you know, of all the interests that I think are best equipped to go to Congress, those are the ones that I think are most likely to generate any legislative answers. Although I'll admit they're a lot less intuitive and kind of less sexy than just, you know, go get a warrant. That's easy for everybody to understand.
But, you know, Michael, you're totally right. When the Digital Due Process Coalition was put together, and it's largely sponsored or financed by a lot of the big providers, this wasn't anywhere close to the radar. It was all the warrant requirement. It was whether the pen register standard needed to be raised, whether subpoenas seeking multiple accounts in one subpoena were unduly burdensome, and then to a lesser extent they were concerned about cell tower information and things like that. But this wasn't on the radar at all, and I think that reflects, we talked about this on the show before, that I think pre-Snowden, when providers were less sensitive about the perception that they were too cozy with the government, these kinds of warrants that are the subject of the Microsoft case were fairly routinely complied with. And now it's become more difficult, little p politically more difficult to comply with them, and now this issue has been raised. It wouldn't surprise me at all if this became the most important issue, because however the Microsoft case comes out, it's pretty clear that this is an issue that the statute needs to address. I think Oren's observations about the warrant requirement are right on. That I used to go to the Hill for 3 years and argue that notwithstanding the Warshaw case, that we needed to fight back against the warrant requirement, and then the department ended up capitulating on that. And you're right, it effectively has become the law of the land, because providers, there's not different standards that apply in different circuits. The providers require whatever the highest standard is. And it does underscore the fact that it's hard to get anything passed through Congress, because now you have a situation where the providers and the government and the courts all seem to agree that the standard is a warrant for all, and we can't even get a bill passed that says that.
Yeah, to go slightly into the weeds for a second, one fascinating dynamic, I think, with the statute offering less privacy protection than what the Fourth Amendment precedents, at least right now, suggest, is that, if the government can find a provider willing to give up contents with less process than a warrant and get the information with only a subpoena or a 2703D order, they then would have the good faith exception under Illinois versus Krull against a Fourth Amendment challenge. So ironically, the current statute may be decreasing privacy protection by providing this good faith exception argument instead of raising privacy protection, which is, of course, what the statute was trying to do. So it's a mess, but one that, with any sophisticated provider, they're always going to fight back with the warrant requirement, and it's weirdly kind of a done deal, it seems.
Yeah, it certainly becomes harder for the department to argue that the world will come to an end if a warrant requirement becomes the standard, when they've lived with the warrant requirements basically since 2010.
Can you really argue good faith if you're the Justice Department and the Attorney General has said that a warrant is required?
Well, I think the Attorney General said is that the department won't oppose a change in the law that would make a warrant required. But, I think if you're in the Sixth Circuit, you can't make that argument. But
right.
I think in other places you might be able to.
You could be a state prosecutor who says, Eric Holder doesn't control me and what sort of authority I use to get information for a state investigation.
It's actually just one observation about that. I think that's a terrific observation, because one of the things that is, I think, often misunderstood about the statute is that it applies to state law enforcement as well. And it's supposed to be the law of the land, not just the law of the land for federal prosecutors. And a lot of the problems with access to data that doesn't comply with the statute, I think, are at the state level. And that's a lot of the actions by local law enforcement, local prosecutors that don't comply with the statute because they may not understand it or realize it applies to them or choose to comply with it, has created a lot of the great examples that you read about in the New York Times and elsewhere about how the statute isn't sufficiently protected.
The other legislative issue that is high on the list of the digerati that doesn't seem to be making much headway is changing the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and in particular dealing with the provision that Oren talked about earlier, which is what's your authority if you're a user and if you violate terms of service, are you in violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act? Oren, any sense about whether that's more likely than ECPA reform to get through?
I don't think it's very likely to get through. I think we're seeing more action on this in the courts. Southern District of New York recently decided a case on this issue that'll go up to the Second Circuit. There's already a circuit split, so Supreme Court, will probably, this is another one where, maybe 2-3 years from now, the Supreme Court will resolve this. I think once the Supreme Court, resolves the issue one way or the other, then you'll probably have, at least a good chance of some legislative reform to either correct the Supreme Court's decision or try to fend off corrections to that decision. But I don't think Congress is likely to touch this until that happens.
What do you think should happen?
Well, I personally think the answer is to remove liability for exceeding authorized access and to just have liability for access without authorization under the statute. That is really just circumventing some code-based restriction, breaking some sort of password gate, sort of, you know, an actual block on access to the computer should be required. And that all of these ideas of punishing violation of terms of service or sort of implicit norms of computer usage are all kind of an idea that we hit on when there was civil litigation between two companies trying to figure out what people should do with other companies' websites and email services. That once you play that out and think of a world in which we use computers every day to do everything, any of those theories of liability just kind of makes everybody a felon in their routine computer usage. So, so that's how I would limit the statute.
You know, one of the things we tried to do when I was at the department is we had drafted a proposal that would try to constrict the statute but not limit it entirely to outside hackers. And it would cover, you know, insiders who abuse their authorization to use their employer's computer system and use it to steal information by grafting onto the statute an additional requirement that even to be prosecuted, not just for penalty purposes, but just to be prosecuted, you have to have stolen information of a certain value or use the stolen information for the purpose of committing another crime. All the things that enhance the penalties under the current statute would be essentially elements of the crime. So you limit it to those situations. You know, you wouldn't have Lori Drews or cases where people just violated Facebook's terms of service, but you would have, and you wouldn't have things like you just described arguing about how you can use someone's website. But a case where someone steals proprietary information from their employer on their way out the door and then uses it to compete or to help someone else compete against the employer, as long as, you know, the information was of sufficient value, you would be able to actually prosecute the case.
And why doesn't the wire fraud statute already cover that?
It depends on the facts, obviously, whether it would be a wire fraud. But if it's a situation in which, you have insider employees who steal stuff before they even know where they're going. You know, they download information to a thumb drive.
Lack of jurisdictional crossing of state lines, is that really the barrier?
Well, there's not necessarily an attempt to defraud. You know, when you steal the information, you're probably violating your non-compete agreement if you have one. You may even be violating a restriction in your employment agreement that says you can't use the information for the benefit of a competitor, but you're not necessarily committing a fraud. If you can do stuff with the information that would violate the wire fraud statute. But we thought that the proposal would get through the Judiciary Committee until Senator Grassley found out that DOJ supported it, in which case he immediately changed his view and said that he opposed it. But the effect would be to prosecute thieves, but not people who accidentally become criminals because they crossed the line in a term of service that they probably never read.
Yeah. I mean, there's case law. The first federal computer crime prosecution was the Seedlitz case from the 1970s. You know, the guy steals data from his employer to start his own business, and the court upheld that as a wire fraud conviction. And it sounds like we're kind of still on the Seedlitz-like facts, you know, 30 years, 40 years later. It does seem to me that in those cases, it's not unauthorized access that's really what's going on. It's a theft case, right? Mm-hmm. So what I find problematic is, you know, we don't have a strong theory of what's unauthorized in terms of computer usage, but hinging the statutes on unauthorized conduct, given that we don't know what unauthorized conduct is, that's what troubles me the most. So I think, you know, a computer theft statute, to the extent the wire fraud statute, doesn't do that, is fair game, but it's the unauthorized access part that I think is really troublesome.
Yeah, I don't think that the solution has to be has to require the preservation of the concept of exceeds authorized access, as long as there was a computer theft statute that could broadly defined cover sort of a broad range of circumstances. Because you're certainly right that it is difficult to defend a statute where the definition of whether the statute is violated depends on what the employer's agreement says. In fact, some of the recent cases that have come out that have come out in favor of the use of the statute against insiders have done so in part because the employers were smart and wrote their use restrictions as access restrictions.
That's assuming that that actually makes a legal difference, which is not
right,
a question.
Right.
But I tend to think the drafting is irrelevant to the underlying question, but there's lower court uncertainty.
Yeah, but the fact that an employer could write something and call it an access restriction and have a prosecution or a civil lawsuit be upheld, but if it's deemed a use restriction, it's not. It
it's a hard way for a federal statute, criminal statute to function.
And I think broadly on the CFAA, this is the problem of having criminal statutes that have a civil enforcement mechanism. The civil provision was added on the theory that, you know, there were going to be so many CFAA criminal prosecutions that the Justice Department could not possibly handle them all. And you had to have civil suits against, you know, the victim company would sue the hacker because DOJ would turn down the solved CFAA case because they just didn't have the resources. And that was kind of an absurd assumption about how things were going to go. And, you know, 25 years later, we still have only something like 150 CFAA prosecutions a year, but we have a massive amount of civil litigation under the statute, which is just not what Congress was thinking at all.
And maybe the source of most of the problems. I wonder if the real answer here, maybe it's not politically possible at this point, would be to say you can't bring a civil case under this. You know, you've got state actions that you could bring before and can bring again, or you can't bring it unless the Justice Department has already said yes, we're going to indict this person.
That would make absolute sense, Stuart, but. There's no political interest or not a lot of political interest in doing that because there are big, powerful companies that still like to bring CFAA civil suits.
Yeah. So I think we probably ought to close this off. We're just past the one-hour mark. What we usually do as we're finishing up is ask people if they have any upcoming speaking engagements, law review articles. I hesitate to ask Oren that for fear that will take another 20 minutes. But this is the chance to plug anything that you think our listeners might be interested in.
one article that I is relevant to some of the issues we've been talking about. I have an article, The Fourth Amendment and the Global Internet, forthcoming in the Stanford Law Review, all available on SSRN.com. Which talks about how these, you know, the Fourth Amendment applies outside the U.S. and a lot of really interesting puzzles that the courts haven't gotten to yet that they will, that I think are kind of fun to work through.
That's great. I have a meeting scheduled with a bunch of wildlife in Yellowstone later in the month, but before I go, I'm actually going to spend, I was invited by the Australian Senate to testify to them about some of their legal and espionage oversight regimes. Rather annoyingly, I don't get a trip to Canberra out of this, but I do get to stay up late and talk on Skype. So I'll be testifying to the Australian authorities on the it's the 28th, I believe to them it's the 29th of July. Michael, but Jason, anything coming up?
It's a little far away, but on September 18th, Patrick Merck, who's the general counsel of the Bitcoin Foundation, and I are doing a panel in San Jose for the International Association of Privacy Professionals on legal issues related to Bitcoin. So buy your tickets now.
All right. Well, actually, I should warn listeners who were counting on this that we will probably put the Steptoe Cyber Law podcast on hiatus for the month of August on the theory that in Washington nothing really happens in August or shouldn't if there's a God in heaven. While we reserve the right to change our mind about that and cover some breaking events with an interview, right now the plan is after next month's next week's podcast, we will be taking a 4-week hiatus and coming back in September, the day after Labor Day. Don't be surprised if we don't show up on your phone in 2 weeks from now. And thank you again, Oren. This was terrific. It was a great workout for computer fraud and electronic crimes lawyers. Thanks, Jason.
Yeah, it's true. It's a small club, but we're very enthusiastic. Michael, Jason, thanks very much for your participation. And this has been episode 29 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. We hope you'll join us again next week when we will once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.